If you're not in the trucking and transportation industry, you may not realize what's going on. How can we live locally and stop CO2 pollution when there are so many companies out there who think that the only answer for society is to build more roads and to increase the number of trucks on those roads? We are making trade deals that are not covered in the news, but deals that do affect our lives. Most people don't even realize about the superhighways that connect three countries until their own property is appropriated.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message. Wake up. Every station is a gentrification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. But do we even know who plants the seed? You think the media works for you, but it's a job for them. They're just selling fruit.
The other side of the news.
Ignorance grows on the spirit like a tumor. Till freedom is a rumor.
The only news I hear comes right from those town meetings, being recorded by a citizen and thrown up on YouTube or similar web-based podcast radio show. But I am finding those reports disappear pretty quickly. How can people fight the climbing air pollution and increase in climate change when those who want more roads are the closest to the politicians? Well, people like Dr. Suzuki wrestle with politicians to get the message through their heads that we must stop adding CO2 into the air. There are many other consultants on the lecture circuit to lead the charge for more transportation. People like Dan Goodwill and Associates. Dan Goodwill is just one of those consultants the trucking industry is looking to for solutions. Without constant growth, there doesn't seem to be an ability for profit, and profit seems to be the only basis for our society. When I started looking for information on the Mid-Penn Highway coming to the Hamilton area, I couldn't find much of anything from mainstream news outlets. But by switching viewpoints, I managed to find lots of information on the web that gives the details of the Mid-Continental Highways already being built across Canada. It started with NASCO and the trade deals that were put together between five member states to create NASCO. Independent video from town halls were showing that the mega highway began in Texas. From there, it joined with Oklahoma, Kansas, Iowa, and Missouri, and reached as far north as Winnipeg, Manitoba, where it is called the Red River Trade Corridor. It includes private businesses with deals that also include the Ambassador Bridge between Detroit and Windsor. Ontario is the major route for more international truck traffic than any other border crossing in America. Most of the original states were farming communities. But farmland was being appropriated to make room for the TTC, the Texas Trade Corridor. Up to now, I hadn't realized how advanced this trade corridor actually was.
I'm going to begin explaining to you what is probably going to be coming through our state of Texas. And I say probably because we've tried for 4 years to stop this thing, and the powers that be are not going to let that happen. But this is what all the NAFTA superhighways are supposed to look like across our country. And it is 1,200 feet wide, 4 football fields wide. In Texas alone, we're going to have 4,000 miles of this that crisscrosses our state. It's going to take 146 acres per mile to build. And so in Texas alone, that's over 584,000 acres that's going to be taken out of mostly private hands. Their own environmental impact statement says that 1 million families, Texas families, are going to be displaced because of this road. 1 million. And that doesn't even seem to get a tickle out of anybody in politics. They don't care. What they're looking at is the bottom line, because they don't have to raise taxes to build new roads. Because out of this whole deal, we're bringing in Centro Zacri, who is a Spanish foreign corporation who has paid our Texas Transportation Department $1.2 billion for the privilege of building this road. They don't have to raise taxes now. They can literally use that money any way they want. And we've asked for an accounting of that money and have never gotten it. So there's $1.2 billion that got paid to our state, and nobody knows where it went. It's going to cost $183 billion eventually to build this. It's going to be 1,200 feet wide. It's going to split property in half. There's not going to be any access. This is going to be foreign trucks coming out of Mexico, just barreling through our state. What's the deal here? Our Republican governor claims is his vision, and this comes from a much higher level. He's being actually told what to do. And so starting down in Texas, that's in Laredo, Texas, where I happen to be born. And it goes all the way to the Canadian border in Splits in Kansas City. They've got a website. It's called NASCO, the North American Super Corridor Coalition. And this is a nonprofit group that our Congress has actually funded, given money to lobby Congress to create this corridor system in our country. But it literally is a system that is going to be able to allow countries like China to ship in their goods to Mexico, put it on trucks, and put it on railroads, and ship it across our country. And literally, Texas will be nothing more than a speed bump, because the first time all that will get inspected is in Kansas City at what they call the smart port. And so there will be other ports in the nation where all of these goods, instead of at our border, are inspected, that will go into the center of our country and get inspected. And we're doing our best, believe me, to stop this. But I will tell you, it is one of those battles that I'm afraid of, because there's so much money behind this that's what you're fighting, is greed and the corporate dollar in this issue. So,
Margaret is the executive director of Stewards of the Range, a national property rights organization headquartered in Boise, Idaho. Under her direction, Stewards Now has grown from a small grassroots group into an influential national property and constitutional rights organization with over 6,000 members already.
As Dan told you, we became involved in this issue really after he came home from the 2005 legislative session. Dan has lobbied for a lot of years in Texas. And at the end of that session, you know, he came home and he said, there's just nothing's going to happen in the state house. We're not going to be able to stop this there. We were involved in it because it's a key property rights issue. This is a land grab. It's not a transportation plan. It's a land grab. There actually were a lot of organizations that had already sprung up to deal with this issue directly, and they have been very effective. Corridor Watch, Blacklands Coalition, Independent Texans. And really through their work, they made the Trans-Texas Corridor one of the top campaign issues through this last election cycle. What Dan and I had learned, and just from our experience in working on property rights issues, we knew that we were going to have to find a different way to go about this than through the State House. And so we began looking at some other alternatives. One of the interesting things that was going on is TxDOT signed a contract, an engineering contract, with Center Zachary. A law firm and a newspaper company tried to get a hold of the contract and they wouldn't release it. So the Attorney General made a ruling saying that TxDOT had to release it. It was a public contract. It was a state agency that signed a contract. The people should know what's in it. But TxDOT decided still not to give that contract out. So the newspaper and the law firm were suing. And so Dan and I got with some of our neighbors, and we decided that we were going to attempt to intervene. One of the key problems with this lawsuit is the Attorney General's office was defending their decision that TxDOT had to release the contract, and the Attorney General's office was also defending the Transportation Department as their lawyers. The media is opposed to the Trans-Texas Corridor. I mean, you can't really say the media is for or against anything, but conservatives and liberals alike in the media are opposed to this in the state of Texas. This is important. I was telling you that the media has really been very favorable to us in this. They've had the story right. There have been great editorials out by liberal reporters in the state of Texas that have blasted the TTC. Nobody in Texas likes the Trans-Texas Corridor, including the media. So a company called Marquis McQuarrie, it's an Australian company that is a partner of Centra Zachary. And this Australian company purchased a series of newspapers in Texas and Oklahoma. The blue line on this map is the corridor, the I-35 corridor, the one that comes a mile from our house. And the red dots are the newspapers that they bought. These newspapers have been very vocally opposed to the Trans-Texas Corridor. But we expect them to be a little silent now. But TxDOT, prior to this, got the approval to do their own environmental impact study. So they've done all the groundwork, all the research. They're just waiting for the federal approval. So we expect it's going to get the same federal approval stamp that everything else about this is.
For anybody that lives in Hamilton, that last passage we just heard sounds all too familiar. What I'm trying to point out is, just because it's not happening in your neighborhood doesn't mean it's not going to affect you. And the other thing I wanted to point out is that all neighborhoods, they all operate the same way. Developers get around laws the same ways in Texas, pretty much as the same way they do here in Hamilton.
So you have to pay attention. And this came from a town hall meeting where some regular citizen in the community went in there and recorded the discussion and then just threw it up on YouTube.
Trying to find the links from anything in NASCO site is an exercise in frustration. It is very hard to find out the details of these highways, and I say highways because it isn't just the TTC. There are many other names being used to divert people's attention. Then I discovered North American Inland Ports Network. On that webpage was the same map of North America that is posted on the NASCO page. So what are inland ports? They are the replacement for shipping ports, with the carrier now being transport trucks. These ports are the agenda of the fuel industry, and by that I include the trains, trucks, airplanes that burn fuel in transporting goods into the United States and Canada from Asia, and resources out of Canada and Mexico into the United States. Their aim is to change the physical highway grids to allow the continuation of exploiting raw materials and cheap labor for the international markets. The mega superhighway originally started by traveling north alongside of Interstate I-35, and by this time you can actually see it from Google Earth. One of the first clues a Canadian should have that the transportation agenda will continue and increase would be the lack of real concern over the loss of ice in the Arctic. Instead of showing concern over the fast loss of sea ice, the Canadian government is focused on who controls the water, the land, and the minerals and oil underneath it. It fits into the plans of more highways to transport more goods and materials as far as Hudson's Bay, as the newest port in Canada. As far as the U.S. superhighway, now it travels through 11 states.
2005, an arrangement between Canada, Mexico, and the United States was made. This arrangement, unannounced to the public, unregulated by Congress, merges the United States, Mexico, and Canada into one entity, erasing all borders. It's called the North American Union. You might want to ask yourself why you've never heard of this.
Power. This is people paying attention. This is listening to alternative media. This is understanding that when 600 of the richest people in the world get together and say they're going to do something, they ain't just whistling Dixie. There's talk at the highest level to simply let the Federal Reserve note just go. Let it slide. Let our currency just completely go into the abyss. They introduced the Amero. The Amero will be backed by silver. And now we have, just like the Euro that they introduced about 12 years or so ago in Europe, this is all a drive towards the merger of the U.S., Mexico, and Canada into the NAU, the North American Union.
In Canada, we see Winnipeg as a major port with links to the Canadian National Rail Line and the Canadian Pacific Line that will become the Mid-Continental Transportation Corridor from east to west, and to the Mid-Penn Corridor, which will eventually allow for international trade routes to three coasts in Canada. But Harper is selling tar oil to the world, from the tar sands through pipelines to refineries located near freshwater, and that means the Great Lakes, and out through these new mega highways to his international buyers. While Dr. Suzuki and Al Gore try to wake politicians up to the dangers of increasing the burning of fossil fuel, consultants like Dan Goodwell are traveling the continents to inspire trucking companies to embrace these new inland transportation ports for their warehousing needs.
To talk about the trade deals, we managed to catch Maud Barlow when she was in town.
I'm Bill Hickey, and I'm president of the Hamilton and District QP Council. In regards to the interprovincial and international trade agreements that are plodding forward with little or no consultation or public discussion. The agreements threaten our local services and economies. They give corporations rights over human rights. I would like to welcome Maud Barlow.
We had another lovely little piece of news tonight. Any of you who have been following the Site 41 story, this is a fight up in Simcoe County where we've been trying to protect the Alliston Aquifer for many years. And we got involved in the last year, and we had a huge win because they're going to put a dump site there. And we had a huge win in the summer when County Council decided finally to listen to the people and made a decision to back off. And it was very moving at the County Council meeting when they agreed to a moratorium, and then a month later they killed it all together. But at that moratorium, there was a mayor there from one of the small little towns in the area, and he was a big guy, retired, and he was tough. And he said, you know, I voted for Site 41 every single time it's come up for 25 years or whatever, and I was going to vote for it again that day. And when he got up that morning, on his desk in his home office, his grandchildren had taken a dump Site 41 sign, or stop dump Site 41 sign, and put the word Papa on it, meaning this is your job, Papa. We're giving you this job to stop it. And he started to cry right in front of, I don't know, 500 people in the balcony and all the media. He said, my grandchildren this morning wrote a new job description for me. My new job description is that I am now a steward of the water here, and I'm voting for the moratorium. It was extraordinarily moving. But what happened was, what was not finalized was that the certificate of approval from the Ontario government was not revoked, which means that some county council in the future could go back to it, or more distressingly, they might sell it, which is what we're worried about. So there's a private members bill, and it passed second reading today. I think I'm right, Mark. So it was really very exciting. So we're anticipating that means it's going to pass altogether. So now the last thing we have to do is get the arrests revoked. My favorite story was the 80-year-old who was baking butter tarts for the church bazaar when she was arrested. She had the police come in and sit down and have butter tarts before they hauled off to prison. Not prison. She was quite sweet. She said, I've never even had a parking ticket, but she said, if I'm going down, I'm going down for water. So it's a nice story. So we're here tonight to talk, however, about trade. And sometimes people's eyes glaze over when we start to talk about trade. And believe me, there's an intent there for our eyes to glaze over, because they don't want us looking very closely at these issues. The trade issue has been on the back burner a bit for the last few years, but let me tell you, it's coming roaring back. And you would think, in the light of the financial meltdown, that those who have told us that it would be a miracle of economic growth and deregulation and privatization, everything would be just ducky and fine, you'd think they'd be a little sheepish with the financial crisis that the world is going through right now. But no, the Harper government and many of the provincial premiers are now telling us that what we need, in fact, is more of the same medicine that made us sick in the first place, which reminds me of the definition of insanity, which is doing the same thing over and over and hoping you're going to get a different result. So just to remind us what we're already living through with from the first set of agreements. The Canada-US Free Trade Agreement, signed on January 1st, 1989, was the first free trade agreement in the world. It was became the prototype for NAFTA. It became the prototype for the World Trade Organization and for the more than 2,500 bilateral investment and trade agreements in the world right now. It did increase trade dramatically. There is absolutely no question about that. But it led to the greatest income disparity in our country in 70 years. It put huge pressure on our social safety net, gutted our unemployment insurance, our family allowance, and social assistance. It opened our resource sector to voracious transnational corporations. It forced our country to abandon its energy sovereignty, and it put our water heritage at risk. And it also allowed American corporations to sue the Canadian government if any level of government brought in any legislation, health, safety, environment, whatever, that interrupted its ability to continue to make huge profits. There are several of these investor-state challenges now, one against the pesticide bans in Quebec, and another from a big pulp and paper company that has left Newfoundland, a big American company, but saying, we now believe we own the water that we used to use when we were there, and they're claiming rights to that water. The Newfoundland government has the nerve to say, no, you got to use that water when you were creating jobs here. You don't own that water. It belongs to the people of Newfoundland. However, the only redeeming feature of NAFTA and of the trade agreements under the WTO and the bilateral agreements is they did not apply to the next level of government spending, what's called subnational procurement. That's the money that's spent by provinces and municipalities, school boards, universities, and so on. That's public money that's spent on all the services, everything from social services to roads, water systems, to keeping our streets safe and our air clean and our water clean and so on. We're trying to get a a good handle on how much that is, and we think it's certainly at least $100 billion a year, but more likely closer to $200 billion annually if you add it all up. So this is the mother load, and it makes the federal procurement, which was in NAFTA, and that is that any federal government spending must go to tender to the other NAFTA countries. It's only $5 billion if you exclude defense, so it makes it look quite small, and really this is what they've been after for a long time. What the big business community all over the world now wants is this next level of access to making money. They want the ability to challenge regulations, policies, and standards and practices that they consider to be a barrier to trade, and they also want to compete directly with public sector jobs and public services, and this is very important. Those are the two goals that they have. And what's at stake for Canadians and Ontarians is an all-out corporate assault on public services by private service transnationals, as well as constant challenges to local rules that protect local jobs, promote local economic growth, foster fair trade rules, give preference to local sustainable food production, or specify local content in infrastructure spending. So there are three kind of ways that this is coming at us. They all have the same goal, but there are three kind of areas that we're concerned about. The Harper government is furiously trying to set up a standardization across the country for the provinces in terms of interprovincial trade. And they're trying to get a federal standard for trade mobility and trade investment and labor mobility. It stems from the Agreement on Internal Trade, which was signed in 1995. But the idea now is to upgrade it to bring the provinces and the municipalities under the discipline of international trade agreements, which they're not now. So there are new agreements like the one between Alberta and British Columbia called TILMA, the Trade Investment Labor Mobility Agreement, where a corporation, say, operating in Alberta wants to move into BC and finds that the standards are higher in BC, they can actually sue for a compensation up to $5 million if they find there's been a higher standard and that won't be lowered. So of course they'll be lowered. I mean, the idea is to bring them lower, and the idea eventually is to have that same rule for corporations to sue right across the country. In our province in Ontario on September 11th, this is just 2 months ago, Ontario and Quebec signed the Ontario-Quebec Trade and Cooperation Agreement, which is, again, supposed to eliminate all barriers to trade, investment, and labor mobility. There's also Bill 175, which is a separate labor mobility act, which is now in second reading, but has been, I believe, put off today, so we're hoping that we're going to get some public hearings on this. Now, the new trade deal between Ontario and Quebec will have sweeping new powers, but it never went for public consultation. We never saw a white paper. It did not go to the legislature for approval. We just read about it when the two premiers signed an agreement in September. And yet it empowers private tribunals to impose huge penalties at any level of government takes actions that impede their right to trade and invest. There's going to be a permanent panel of CEOs that will check all new government policies for potential negative impacts on their interests. And I quote, if they find any legislation, regulation, directive, requirement, guideline, program, policy, administrative practice, or other procedure that is a barrier to trade, they're able to challenge it, and penalties for ignoring a ruling can reach up to $10 million. So before it goes to the legislature, new regulations will have to go through this panel of private CEOs to see whether they like it or not. That's basically the bottom line. You may not be surprised, but no similar panel has been set up to check the impact of new economic policies on health or environment or workers' rights or Indigenous rights or anything else. Our lawyer, Stephen Schreibman, says that this deal actually turns the Constitution upside down and puts commercial considerations above all other considerations, including public interest and societal values. So we are demanding, this has already been signed, so we can't say stop it in the sense of don't let it happen, it's happened. But we should be demanding public hearings on this. We should be demanding that it not be implemented until there has been full public hearings, and it should be ratified before the legislatures of the two provinces. It's profoundly undemocratic that this has happened without any involvement of the people of the provinces. So that's the first one. The second one is called the Canada-European Union Comprehensive Economic and Trade Agreement. You know, they're trying to bore us to death. I am absolutely convinced that they make it boring enough that we'll all say it can't be bad because it's too boring to be bad. But it's called. It was like the prosperity and security prosperity partnership for North America. It was a boring title, and they kept saying it doesn't mean anything, and it meant a great deal. But this is the new thing now, is to keep this as quiet as is humanly possible. So the Canada-European Union Comprehensive Economic and Trade Agreement, or CETA, has been being negotiated quietly behind closed doors for about 2 years, and it came out of a meeting between Premier Charest and the Prime Minister and the President of France, Sarkozy, at a meeting held by Jean Desmarais of Power Corporation. And they just completed their very first big negotiations. 200 European negotiators came to Ottawa, and apparently they moved the agenda very, very far, and I'm extraordinarily worried about this. This deal would surpass NAFTA in its scope, in that it is a condition of the European Union that all provincial and municipal public procurement, including public services, have to be included in this deal, or there's no deal. This means that private European service companies would be allowed to compete directly for these contracts and challenge any regulatory barrier that stands in their way. It could affect the management of public pensions. It could open up public auto insurance, public monopolies on alcohol sales, such as we have here in Ontario, to private companies. And it would threaten all provincial bans against public, private health care, private social services, private child care. Two biggest water utilities in the world are Suez and Veolia. They're both from France, and Suez and Veolia are totally and completely behind this agreement, and they have... they're licking their lips, let me tell you, because they want to move into North America. They've been chased out of so many communities in the global south because of their horrible behavior, and now they want to get into the more stable environment here in Canada. And that means they could bid directly for contracts, any utility contract on water across the country. The European Union has already stated its goals to eliminate not only any regulatory differences among the provinces, but any freedom of municipalities, school boards, health authorities, universities, or any level of the province to discriminate in favor of local or national companies when spending public money. They would literally have to open up everything. Now, one reason this deal has not had much created much opposition is exactly the secrecy. You're not reading about it in your newspapers. Whenever it is reported, it's stuck back in the business section, way back at the back of the Globe and Mail. The night that it was announced this deal was to go ahead on the CBC, Neil MacDonald talked about it as the greatest thing since sliced bread. He clearly thought it was a great thing, smiled as he said, "Isn't this great?" So you're not reading about this as a controversial kind of thing, and we have to make it controversial, which is what this tour is about and why we're starting to really rally and put together a network and a campaign across the country. The other reason you're not hearing about it is because many Canadians think, well, isn't Europe better? It's got higher standards. It's, you know, we want to diversify away from the United States. Isn't that a good thing? Two things to know about that. First of all, it is the service corporations in Europe and the companies in Canada that want this agreement because they want access to each other's markets and they want to pull down those higher standards. And for Canada, they want the European Union to stop banning our genetically engineered food exports and our hormone-laced beef. That's one of the big goals for Canada. But the other thing to know is that under NAFTA's most favored nation provision, any new access to some new sector that was left out of a last agreement must be given to our American and Mexican partners, so-called partners in NAFTA. So this means if you open up services to European service companies, you have to open them up to big American companies like the private health corporations who've long had their eye on this. There's no redeeming feature about this European-Canada deal. We have to kill it. It absolutely has to go, and we have to have an all-out campaign on it. So the third of these three kind of areas that we're really concerned about is The Harper government's proposal to the Obama administration to get it exempted from the Obama administration's Buy American provisions of their stimulus package. As you know, they put a lot of money into rebooting their economy. They lost 6 million jobs over the last year. And understandably, the Obama administration has said, we want this to create jobs for manufacturers as well. So they have said, if you're going to take the stimulus money, you cannot use anything but American steel and American manufactured goods. I understand why they're doing that. And it's just this federal counterpart to the Buy American policies that American states have had for something like, 75 years. However, the Harper government is using this crisis to further limit what subnational governments can do. And what he has offered is, he said, we're not even asking for reciprocity. We're not even asking to be able to get into your municipalities and states. We're just saying, let us out of this one-time exemption and we'll give you access to all levels of government. There's a guy named Chris Sands, who's a trade watcher in Washington with the Hudson Institute, and he said a while ago that we would only ever get this if the provinces are willing to put long-cherished exclusions on the table. And he said, the question is Canada willing to concede everything we want? Well, now it turns out, even if we are willing to concede everything they want, the Obama administration is not able to do this. So now what they're talking about is having the provinces sign up to the procurement agreement of the World Trade Organization, which would then permanently open us up to both American and, of course, other countries. And this is a very, very dangerous thing to happen, and it is all happening very, very quickly. So here's where we are. We're at the beginning stage of a campaign to tell Canadians about what this is all about and to put together a campaign in this province but across the country as well to turn this back. Together we have what I call the perfect storm of trade and investment deals whose sole aim is to remove the remaining abilities of subnational governments right down to school boards and hospitals to use public taxpayers' money in a way that promotes fair trade, public values, and environmental sustainability if any of those rules interfere with the interests of these corporations. Just as an example, Ontario has this Green Jobs program where they will give money for conversion to wind and solar, but you have to put a certain amount of it into investing in Canadian jobs and Canadian manufactured or energy alternative technologies. That would all be challengeable. You could not maintain that kind of local protection. I don't know if any of you heard it today, but I was on a debate on CHCH at 5:30 with a young woman from, she'd interned at the Fraser Institute. She's home on maternity leave, and she just kind of spouted capitalism 101 mantra, and everything was good, and she, this is the best thing. And she said, NAFTA left a hole that we have to fill in, and the hole was that, what I was talking about, the fact that these subnational governments were left out. And she said, why would you want to not have the cheapest goods possible? Why would you not want to, why would you not want to open up every level of government and every level of service to competition so we have the cheapest services and the cheapest goods? And I said, because we wouldn't have anybody left to buy them. That's why everybody has to go to Walmart. But this is what we're up against. We're not up against a thoughtful response to the financial crisis that says, well, maybe we overdid it and maybe we have to come back a little bit. We're up against people who are saying, let's complete the journey. Let's go all the way. I think about a guy named Grover Norquist, who was the tax advisor to the Bush administration, and he used to define government, the appropriate level of government, is small enough to put in a bathtub, and then you can pull the plug. I mean, that literally, that notion of take government down to its smallest size and give and bring in this kind of constitutional overview, because that's what a treaty is, and that's why it's so important. We insist that it go to our legislatures, because it is a new level of law that overrides your domestic law. And in fact, if your domestic law contradicts this new law, you actually have to bring in legislation to change your domestic law so that it doesn't contradict these trade agreements anymore. And then you have these trade bureaucrats and these corporate CEOs who sit and watch for every new piece of legislation that comes along to be sure that it's not trade restrictive. So that's what we call the chill effect, and we never know what doesn't come forward because some trade bureaucrat or some CEO said, we'll challenge this. And we don't know to this day what kind of good laws we have not been able to implement because of this. Now, I'm going to stop, and Michael's going to speak, and then we're going to open this up to discussion. But I want to say to you that I am not feeling at all hopeless about this. I'm worried about it, very worried. But I'm also wanting to remind us that we have been on a winning streak on these trade agreements, and we need to be on them again. Yes, we lost the first Canada-US free trade agreement because although the hearts and minds of two-thirds of Canadians were against it, the vote was split between three parties, and the Conservatives won, and we got the first agreement. We only got NAFTA because Jean Chrétien lied. He said he would never implement NAFTA. Unless there were six fundamental changes. And the first thing he did when he took office was he ratified NAFTA. And I remember when he did so and he announced that he wouldn't look into the camera because he knew perfectly well that he wasn't telling the truth. But we won that. We won the battle of hearts and minds, if you will. But ever since, we've won them all. We stopped NAFTA from being exported to Latin America. It was called the Free Trade Area of the Americas. We led from Canada the fight against the Multilateral Agreement on Investment, which would have given corporations all over the world the right to sue governments here in Canada and around the world if they started bumping into higher standards as they moved across borders. We're so successful with that campaign that the French cabinet, the cabinet of France, put out a statement when they pulled out and said that our material, our legal opinions, our documents, our research were so much better than their old trade bureaucrats that they ended up thinking that we were right and their trade bureaucrats were wrong. It was quite lovely. The Security and Prosperity Partnership for North America, you may or may not know, but it's dead. If you go to the Secretary of State website in the United States and you punch in Security and Prosperity Partnership for North America, it will say that it no longer exists. Now, some of the damage was done. We did adopt a lot of the worst of George Bush's Homeland Security provisions, and so yes, we have that concern. It's not like, you know, it didn't leave damage in its wake, but it was profoundly undemocratic. And we got an invitation 2 years ago when we were really making a lot of noise about the SPP from the American Embassy in Ottawa. And they said, we'd like to meet with you because we've been told we haven't consulted properly, so we're going to consult with you. Yeah, a little late, right? Oh, you've been talking to your CEO friends and it's, you know, finally you notice somebody else. They invited us to their to the American Embassy, and I said, we're not going to the bunker, though. They can come to us. But we had this meeting, and I said to them, why is it that a NAFTA the SPP did not go to the three countries for ratification? And the senior bureaucrat there said, because we didn't want another bruising NAFTA battle. And I said, in other words, you think you might have lost? And he said, yes. He was admitting that when the light of day is shone on these agreements and when we learn what's in them, Canadians don't want them, Americans don't want them. When the Europeans find out that their quid pro quo is they're not going to be able to maintain control over their food standards, they're not going to want this agreement either. So their best bet is just to keep the lid on this thing and not let it out to be talked about or anything else. So we can do this again. We won the SPP and we can do it again. It's very important that we are strong, that we understand we're at the beginning of a campaign. Now we have good materials here to start with. We're going to be developing fact sheets. We're going to be developing sector-specific fact sheets. We're going to be developing videos and so on for people to take back into their workplaces and their schools and their churches and communities and so on to do what we've done before. We actually had over 600 anti-MAI or MAI free zones across the country at one point. We actually counted them up from high schools to libraries to seniors' residents to universities to you name it. we actually got this thing off the ground and we can do it again. Because if we don't do it, all of the work that we're doing in our communities, from labor rights and human rights to environment to social justice to protecting health to protecting social services, all of that is going to be subsumed into these agreements. There's a French philosopher, 19th century French philosopher named Jean Rostand, and he used to say, "It is terrible to see everything that you once detested coming back wearing the future, the colors of the future." They're talking about this as the great new thing. This is not a great new thing. This is all about unlimited growth, which one American environmentalist said has the same DNA as the cancer cell and has to turn on its host in order to survive. We cannot keep doing this to the planet. We cannot keep doing what we're doing, more and more and more stuff, more trade, Niagara turning into a port. What are they calling it, a gateway now? They're talking gates, ports, portals, superhighways, St. John, New Brunswick, Halifax, in Vancouver, Victoria. These are all ports and portals now for this imagined huge growth in global trade when the world is running out of energy very, very quickly. A very important new report came out yesterday saying that its peak oil is happening much faster than we thought. The world is running out of fresh water, which is a subject near and dear to my heart, and I can tell you that it is. We are a planet in crisis. We are running out of fish in the sea and old-growth forests. We simply cannot continue to do this. And the whole concept of subsidiarity, which is that if something can be grown or produced closer to home, then you're going to have policies that support that. Doesn't mean we won't import bananas or export maple syrup. Somebody asked last night, what will we try to grow bananas here? And I said, no, of course not. We're still going to have trade. But we're not going to turn ourselves inside out for these corporations, and we're not going to serve the god of trade. We're going to say trade and the economy serve communities. And we have to move back to more sustainable food production, to more sustainable manufacturing, to local jobs and local economies. We're going to have to move back there because the earth cannot sustain what we're doing. And I don't want to keep throwing out vacuum cleaners and everything else that break after a year, because they were made to break after a year and there's nowhere to take them back because we have created this terrible cycle. It has to stop. And it's going to stop when we decide it's going to stop. And we've got to get angry in this country. I want to get a little passion back in our feelings about this. When we fought NAFTA, we fought tough, and we picketed, and we were out there. We were in their face, and we've become too polite. We've become too accepting that we perhaps can't change things. And I want us to know that we can, that we have to. Invite you to be part of this struggle. I'm absolutely committed to this, and particularly the Canada-European agreement. I think is the most dangerous agreement we've ever looked at, and I am personally committed to doing to it what we did to the MAI and to the Security and Prosperity Partnership for North America. And I thank you so much.
Okay, our next speaker is Michael Hurley. He's the first vice president of the Ontario Division of CUPE, and he's the president of the Ontario Council of Hospital Unions. And I welcome Mike.
One of the things we're going to ask is that if you could give some of your time, as they did in setting up this meeting, if you could give some of your time to this campaign, there's no question that we can set back the trade agreements. I'd like to thank, on behalf of the CUPE locals that are here, and got a number of CUPE locals here, Maude Barlow and the Council of Canadians for the partnership that we have with you. This trade tour is going to go national with CUPE and the Council of Canadians. It's going to expand into the universities here in Ontario. We're going to add more cities to this campaign. We're going to push. And you'll hear much more about that later. So first of all, I'd like to talk about the financial deregulation that Maude alluded to. That's where people are extended credit that they really perhaps can't afford. And that credit is bundled up into financial instruments that are sold. And the defaulting on that credit brings down some financial institutions. We've all invested billions, trillions of dollars in propping up those investment banks. And we're going to hear about that as these governments come back to us to cut public services to pay for the largesse they've extended to the banking sector. But one of the things I'd like to ask is, why was it that, for example, Americans, because we were to some extent protected because our banks were a little bit more rigorous in their lending practices, but why was it in particular that Americans were living on borrowed credit? Why is it that 1 in 10 Americans today, according to the New York Times, is in default on their mortgage payments? Why is it that so many people are unemployed in the United States? And the reason, I think, is because the American economy has been brutalized by the free trade agreements that it's been promoting. And in fact, to some extent, Ontario isn't that different. Certainly the city of Hamilton isn't that different. You know, Stelco, for example, which used to employ thousands of people, is, you know, pretty much down, right? And the Niagara Peninsula has been devastated. Eurocopter and tons and tons of mills, etc., plants that used to produce goods, used to hire people, are shuttered. And so in Northern Ontario as well, in Kenora, in Dryden, in Sioux Lookout, in Espanola, in Cochrane, the mills that used to produce pulp and paper are gone. They're shut down, and the Communication, Energy, and Paper workers say the work will never come back. The work will never come back because it's gone to Brazil and places like that where labor's cheaper. And in Cornwall, where Levi's and Domtar are gone, or Phillips Cable in Brockville, or Hershey's in Smiths Falls. You can go to every community in this province and you'll find mills and plants that once employed people. St. Thomas, the Ford company that's going to be shutting that plant in 1 year. And that's just typical of the havoc that's been played out in southwestern Ontario in the auto sector, in the auto parts sector. So we have some huge problems in the province of Ontario, not unlike the problems that are faced by people in the United States, because we have lost many of the employment employers who used to provide good-paying jobs. So you would think that the government of Ontario, which has been a little bereft of good ideas, but you would think that the government of Ontario might be thinking, okay, let's get proactive and let's have a job strategy. You might think that they might be thinking, tell you what, we're going to take $1 billion, we're going to create a crown corporation, we're going to open up every mill that's been shut down in Northern Ontario. We're going to say to the people of Ontario, your civic duty is to buy the paper that we're producing from those mills. That's what we want you to do, because that's going to put people back to work in Northern Ontario. That's our responsibility. We're going to buy Canadian-made steel. We're going to get Stelco back up and running. You would think they'd have a strategy like that. Unfortunately, it's kind of the reverse of that. So what have they done? Well, they've signed, as Maud said, the Quebec-Ontario Trade and Cooperation Agreement. And why have they done that? They've done that because in the United States and in Canada, where so many responsibilities for spending, so many programs are delivered provincially by constitution, these governments must agree to lower their trade barriers. Ontario has to be complicit in the lowering of trade barriers. It can't be done at a national level. So what have they agreed to? They've agreed to make investment and trade the paramount items in decision-making for our province. They've done it without any reference to the provincial parliament. There's no statutory framework for the trade and cooperation agreement. It never went to a public debate. It never went to a legislative committee. None of us ever heard about it until they inked it. And they will judge existing programs and new programs against whether they are in the interests of trade and investment. And if there's a dispute about that, there are private tribunals that can be invoked by the government of Quebec that will make decisions about the propriety of those programs. And those tribunals can operate in secret. They're not open to the public. They operate confidentially, and they can impose fines. And these decisions around trade and investment, they are going to affect us in agriculture. including like organic labeling or genetically modified food labeling, in the environment, environmental protection. They're going to overrule transportation. They open up the insurance industry to this competition, which is a concern to us in healthcare, particularly because OHIP is an insurance program, and that's what provides our Medicare system and the health, hospital insurance. And they have also worked on the labor mobility problem. We had a lawyer, QP in the Council of Canadians, Stephen Schreiman, a brilliant lawyer, trade specialist with Sack Goldblatt Mitchell. We had him look at the trade and cooperation agreement, particularly interested in the area of labor mobility. Quebec and Ontario are now claiming that they have resolved our labor mobility problems. What are our labor mobility problems between Quebec and Ontario? Well, there was at one time a problem for construction workers practicing their trade in either province. Beyond that, there aren't any problems. What have they done in Ontario? They've introduced two pieces of legislation. One piece of legislation puts 300 occupational groups into a college. Swine herders, apiarists, carpenters, plumbers, early childhood educators, arborists, and the people who sell you your hardware at Home Hardware. All of these are regulated professions. They're all in a college. Of course, the labor movement's typical kind of slow-moving response to to that legislation was to say, oh, gee, how many seats will we get on the board? But Stephen opened our eyes a little bit because he said, you know why they're doing this, right? They're doing this because under the labor mobility agreement, if somebody from another province is an early childhood educator, but that province only has a 3-month program, but ours is 2 years, we have to recognize their certificate. And if we don't recognize their certificate, we're liable to be fined $5 million in every case where we don't recognize a certificate. So the Ontario government had to create a college for that purpose. So that's why 300 occupations have been grouped together. They have no community of interest at all. So the interprovincial trade agreement is critical to opening up our public services in the province of Ontario, our municipal spending, our school board spending, our hospital spending, our social service programs to competition. The McGuinty government has brought this legislation in secret, and if people know about it, they'll be appalled and they won't support it. This is a government that hates controversy. And we're going to bring them controversy on this one. And we're going to bring them controversy on the EU deal as well. So what we're asking you tonight, what we need from you are your ideas. Not just questions. We want to hear from you in terms of what you think about this. We want to know what you think we should all be doing collectively. And we want to leave here with some commitments that we're going to make a presentation to the regional council here, to the school boards here. We want to start doing things in this community, organizing an event at the universities here, in your workplaces, if that's helpful, so that we can get the volume turned up on these trade deals.
While Dr. Suzuki and Al Gore try to wake politicians up to the dangers of increasing the burning of fossil fuel, consultants like Dan Goodwill are traveling the continents to inspire trucking companies to embrace these new inland transportation ports for their warehousing needs. If you listen to Dan Goodwill talk, you will be able to make the connections to all of these superhighways. One of the transit companies he talks to is Omnitrax, which is currently busy involving building more rail lines between the port of Churchill on Hudson's Bay to connections in Winnipeg. But it isn't just a truck and train corridor. There are many airports also being built as well. As Jerome R. Corsi, a columnist for the World Net Daily and author of many books on the NAU, states, the transportation industry is one of the major pollutants of CO2 gas emissions resulting from road transportation and represents approximately 30% of all energy consumed in Canada, making mobility and transportation systems a major climate change issue. From 1990 to 2006, greenhouse gas emissions from transportation rose 32% in Canada alone. Overall, transportation was the second largest emission-producing category in 2006. According to Environment Canada, Trip volume across the Ottawa River, for example, increased over 20% in the past 10 years. And the volume between urban and rural areas increased 90% at the same time. How can it be possible to lower our CO2 emissions while these trade deals are being coveted by Mr. Harper and being backed by these super transportation corridors that will include more trucks, more trains, and more airports, increasing at an incredible rate?
Unemployment could reach as high as 8%. But if there is some good news in all this, they talk about a so-called misery index, which is unemployment plus inflation. And that's likely to hit somewhere around the 10% mark. So when you think back, and I see a few guys in this room that are probably somewhere in my age bracket, let's say, you saw the recession of the 80s. I mean, there's nobody in this room that was around in the Great Depression, but even in the early 80s, you saw the misery index up in the 20-25% range. Some of you may remember mortgages at 18% or 19% interest and that kind of thing. So really, if there's any consolation, it's bad the way things are right now, but it's not as bad as it could be, and it's not as serious as some folks suggest. So getting back to the good times of the early 2000s, I would argue, is going to be years away. We had some wonderful years in this business, and I know those of you running trucking companies have probably had some of the best years you've ever seen, but it's going to take a while. There is significant truck capacity leaving the North American market. There are numerous companies that have gone. I suspect we'll see several other announcements over the next few months, big and small, and that capacity will come out. But that means, I think, as we come out of this recession, there'll be some good news. And the good news is that the companies that are left will be much stronger, better managed, more solid financially, positioned for growth. And what's also really good is that very likely that rates will start to increase, because in these times, opportunities are presenting themselves. And so it's really important not to just think defensively, but to think offensively, that opportunities are presenting themselves that you may never see again. As I see it, there's three approaches. There's the ostrich approach, which says, we're in a recession, it's not great, but we've been there before, and it's going to pass, and we're going to be okay. So let's just tough it out. Let's just stay status quo. And that sounds pretty good, doesn't it? I mean, there's no disruption. Everybody's fine. Everybody's happy. Everybody's got a job. But there's something fundamentally wrong with that assumption. And what's fundamentally wrong with it is that it's not about you, and it's not about your company. Your company services customers. And if you talk to your customers today, I almost guarantee you, they're going through changes. They're closing warehouses. They're changing their factories. They're realigning the way they serve Canada. They're not going to have a Canadian warehouse. They're going to ship direct from Chicago or whatever they're going to do. So a lot of companies, a lot of shippers throughout North America are going through some major changes. So my point is that you need to know where they're at, and you need to know that in order to fine-tune where your company's going. The bull in the china shop approach is, and a lot of folks do the slash and burn thing, and they think, I've done the right thing. So I've announced a 5% cut. Okay? So we're going to cut 5% of the people right across the company. We're cool. That should do it. But what happens when you do that? What happens when you do that is you have some parts of your business that are good and that are strong and that are earning good contributions, and then you've got other parts of your business that are not as good, not as strong, and so you're cutting everything equally. And I would challenge you folks on the basis that that may not be the right thing to do. Do you actually, we're going to talk about this again when we talk about people, but do you need to make these cuts? Can you get more creative? Is there another way to do it? What if you, I know you're going to hate me for saying this, but what if we reduce salaries? Kept the people, lowered the salaries, right? What if you gave people a shorter work week? Just saying, there are various ways to skin a cat, but just to go out there and say, this customer is unprofitable, we're going to bop them right now. Their contribution margin is no good, and we're going to toss them out. And then what happens a few months later, you say, God, why did I do that? You know, we really needed that backhaul freight, and we can't find other backhaul freight. So now we're running, and this lane is, whatever, X percent empty. Don't shoot yourself in the foot. So the third approach is saying, be methodical. Think about what you're doing. Look at the whole picture, and very carefully craft a plan that's going to lead your company out of the crisis.
That was Dan Goodwill talking to a trucking conference in Toronto last fall. Canada has been basically taken over, as Maude Barlow has pointed out, by a transnational corporation, a handful of them that make deals through NAFTA. The way NAFTA has been set up, countries can't defend themselves. We have to get rid of NAFTA. We have to be aware of what NAFTA does, and she did a pretty good job explaining it there. But NAFTA giving rights to any corporation, saying that any country that cuts their potential to make money would be fined, is just purely illogical and not in step with the times. This has been The Other Side of the News. I'm your host, Maggie Hughes, and thanks for listening.
Redefining Radio.
CFM.